Ladies and gentlemen, Flanders Fields, Chapter 16, Victory.
On the 9th November, 1918, 2 days before the unexpected end, the 2nd and 3rd Divisions of the Canadian Corps had reached the outskirts of Mons, where it had all begun. For it was here at Mons, in King Albert's brave little Belgium, that the small professional force, described in Kaiser Wilhelm's most quoted words as that contemptible little army which Great Britain had rushed to France in August 1914, had had its first encounter with the highly refined end product of German militarism, a conquering German army that had smashed its way in triumph across the Belgian frontier to press relentlessly forward till it neared the gates of Paris. Now, 51 months later, the tide of German fortune at the flood in August of 14 was at the Nieppe. Now a beaten German army stood in desperation to stem the flow of a British advance. Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry were the first to feel their way down Mons' outlying streets.
We entered the outskirts of Mons on the 9th of November, and that's where we met our first severe resistance in 4 or 5 days. The Germans were in every house, making it very hot for us.
I was with the 42nd Canadian Battalion, the Royal Highlanders from Montreal, as a junior officer commanding a platoon. We were following up the two front battalions of the 7th Brigade. The RCRs and the Patricias were doing the actual advance on Mons, and during the morning of November the 10th, we were ordered forward to go through them. We pushed ahead and found the Patricias in a suburb of Mons, a village by the name of Quem. We took over from them.
Curry's idea was that the Princess Pats would take Mons, but they had been on the go so long that they were practically all in. You know, the troops needed a rest, and they were just about finished.
Although the Pats were officially relieved, No. 4 Company, perhaps with a sense of history, asked Brigadier General Clark's permission to remain. It was granted.
We believe that 4 Company had a tip-off of some kind, that the armistice was coming within a few hours, and therefore they made an effort to stay in with the 42nd until the armistice was celebrated. I think it was very much in the minds of the Patricias to be in at the end because they were the first Canadian unit to be engaged in the First World War.
The rumor factory was working double shifts. Not many soldiers were buying the output. They'd heard those yarns before. But the Pats had some reason to take them seriously.
I think it was the 8th, I'm not certain, that we were cautioned that a German staff car would approach our lines and that we should permit it to go through without interruption. And an hour or two later, this happened. The car approached with white flag flying and officers sitting prim and erect, as the usual fashion was for German officers to sit. They approached and went through our lines without any demonstration of any kind. It was unique, there's no question about that, and we were having our own way so well that we suspected that it could be peace discussions of some kind.
Several thousand Canadians in German POW camps had even better reasons to believe the war was ending.
There had been talk of a revolt of the German Navy, you see. They had got orders to go out and do or die. But they took their officers and threw them in the sea and revolted and swarmed all down from Kiel, Cuxhaven, Wilhelmshaven, all those places, and they formed what they called the Arbeiter- und Soldatenrat, the Soldiers and Workers' Council. The 8th of November, I remember particularly, we ran slap into a roving band of these sailors who had come down, deserted their ships, and so on. And any German officer they were meeting, they were really giving them a rough time. One particular big overbearing so-and-so, whom we had reason to hate, he started shouting in the usual Prussian manner to these sailors. Anyway, somebody took a poke at this officer, knocked him flat on his back. From somewhere, they commandeered a baby carriage, and they picked him up bodily and jammed him right into this bloody baby carriage, you see. And that was the sight of my life. This same blighter who had got us in trouble was being pushed along, and he was jeered and spat upon by his own men. And I gave him some choice little names, too. By the time we got back to camp with all this news, the camp commandant himself, the chap whom we had hated, he'd fallen in a fit of frenzy, cursing at us. He'd burst a blood vessel, and we all cheered when they carried him off.
But the frontline soldier was a hard man to convince. He wore skepticism like a long service medal.
On November the 10th, we were supposed to follow behind an attack by the 7th Brigade. I always remember one of our officers coming back from leave that night and saying, "Have you fellas heard anything about an armistice?" Well, we laughed. We said, "An armistice? No, you'll be fighting here at this time next year." Well, he says, "Down around the base, they're all talking about an armistice."
During the 10th, the story went the rounds that a couple of days before, the Prince of Wales had marched along beside the 49th Battalion of our brigade and told the men to keep their heads down until Sunday when it would be all over. A little later, Mr. Livesey, the war correspondent, came up the road and asked me where the front line was. I told him he was in the front line, and he explained that the armistice was to commence the next day and that he had never been in the front line, wanted to be in the front line before the war ended. Some of my men heard him telling this story, and they simply laughed as we were being shelled at the time.
The disbelief held on, unshaken, through the night of the 10th to the 11th.
I was spending the night of the 10th and 11th November with a sick fellow officer of mine who was burning up with fever, and he wouldn't be paraded to the doctor. And so when he lumbered off upstairs all by his own, there was nothing else I could do but to follow him up there. And then I crawled up on the bed and stretched out a bit myself. And the first thing I knew, I came to with a start. And here was Mac, my fellow officer, sitting straight up in bed. And he had me by my wrist, and he says, "Doc, Doc, listen." And I listened. And all about me was the silence of the tomb. It was eerie. It just had you gripped. "Listen," Mac said. And I listened. There wasn't a sound of a falling bomb. There was no drone of plane. There was no rattle of machine gun. I couldn't hear even a rifle shot. And just when I was trying to size up what was happening, a rooster crowed. And then Mac leaned over and grabbed me by the arm again. He says, "Listen, the damn war's over." And I said, "You're nuts." And I shoved him down on the pillow and held him there. And gradually, he went back into slumber again. And I said, "Well, we'll have to get this kid to the doc in the morning."
We had no appreciation at all of the fact that the whole German front was crumbling. It certainly seemed to be crumbling in front of us. But that didn't indicate to us in any way that the war was about to come to a conclusion. I suppose you don't think it's come to a conclusion too readily if you're still getting sniped at.
Troops of the 4th Brigade, moving across the field south of the city of Mons, implementing a plan of encirclement, encountered a good deal more than sniping on the 10th November.
The Germans were fighting that morning from one position to another as well as any troops we had ever seen in the old line days. They were also supported by a peculiar fact that this Mons had been a machine gun school. All these fellows had been trained over this ground. We found machine gun bullets coming from cabbage patches, house tops, all sorts of fancy positions, and it certainly made a pretty tough proposition.
Directly in front of Mons, the 7th Brigade moved forward gingerly.
Our instructions were to keep pushing the Germans back, but to avoid heavy casualties or getting into any real scrap. I got my men into the houses along the streets, and we kept prodding forward, but to avoid casualties did not make too serious an attack. During the afternoon, Captain Holm of the RCRs, who were over on our left, came to see me, and we arranged that I would put out some light machine guns after dark between his company, attached to our battalion for the show, and my own platoon.
I was commanding a company then, and my company was attached to the Black Watch for that operation, 42nd Black Watch. I relieved a company of the Princess Patricia's on the morning of the 10th of November, just in the outskirts of Mons. Later on that day, we tried to get in, but I got definite written instructions from Colonel Ewing not to attempt to get in until about 3:30 in the morning. It was expected the Germans were going to withdraw.
But with the coming on of night, there was still no sign of the Germans pulling out. Brigadier General Clark discussed the situation with his battalion commanders.
The situation looked so serious that we concluded that it would require a set piece attack in the morning to capture the city. After they left my room, I went to bed and went to sleep promptly. I was awakened by a telephone buzzing. The voice on the other end said, "I'm now at map location so-and-so," and I looked at my map, and I said, "You're in Mons. You've spoiled our attack on Mons in the morning, but I'm delighted," and I told him what to do. And it was Captain Grafty of the 42nd Battalion, whose D Company had entered Mons as we had hoped they might.
After dark, we received a runner from our company headquarters letting us know that D Company of our battalion had managed to push into the outskirts of the city. We then pushed forward. The bridge was down over the canal between us and the city. We built a temporary footbridge and managed to get in.
North of the 42nd, the Royal Canadian Regiment made the third entry of the night. Lieutenant W. Martin King commanded the leading platoon.
Approximately, I would say, at 2 o'clock in the morning, we went over the bridge. The platoon sergeant and I tripped over a rope or a wire, and our fear was that the bridge was mined. So we put a man on, so everybody stepped over. And I might say the engineers, in exploring it next day, found that the bridge was mined, but either it had short-circuited or one contact was missing. From all intents and purposes, we were in the city.
They felt their way cross town in the dark and came to the Grand Place, the central square of Mons, in front of the Hôtel de Ville, the city hall.
And there I encountered the prefect of police. He said, "Would you come in and sign the golden book of this city?" He just appeared out of the dark somewhere. And I said, "Yes, but it'll have to be quick." So I signed this book, in the usual French fashion, kissing one another on the cheeks and so on. And I went out and got our platoon situated on the other side of the city.
There are many illustrious names on that very famous page in the Golden Book of Mons, but the name of a young Canadian lieutenant commanding a fighting platoon leads all the rest. It will stand forever above the generals, the statesmen, and the kings.
As we went through the streets of the city, my men ran their bayoneted rifles along the grills of the cellar windows of the houses. The city was very quiet at this point. The shelling and machine gunning from the enemy had stopped some time before, and eventually, as a result of the bayonets on the grilled windows of the cellars, the citizens of Mons streamed out, calling Les Américains. We explained that we were the Canadians, and there was, of course, great excitement on the street.
We moved in at 3:30 in a frontage of 200 or 300 yards. And we'd no sooner got into the outskirts, daylight just breaking, when windows opened up, Belgian flags came out, the people streamed out the streets with cake and brandy, and there was no firing. The Germans had fallen back.
I went past Mons. I was detailed to go out down the Petitnemy Road in the early hours of the morning and establish a post. There was apparently no sign of any Germans, so I decided to go down the main street to inquire where I could find out where the Germans were. But on the way up this street, we heard a phonograph playing in an estaminet that had opened for business, and that tune that they were playing was the British Grenadiers, and I couldn't believe my ears. Well, I fell into the hands of some civilian who insisted upon parading me to the mayor of Petitnemy, who was bedridden. And he greeted us in the name of Belgium and made a little speech. And they sent out for a man who could speak English. And he told me that the Germans had fallen back across the canal and they hadn't blown up the canal, which was the information I wanted.
The 2nd Division, which was sweeping on south of the city, was now turning north to link up with the 3rd Division and come at it from the rear.
My brigade had been given an objective, which was one of the suburbs of Mons, a place called Hion. And it's true that my particular platoon got lost and actually entered the city and went through the city in the early hours of the morning.
They came very close to being trapped by retreating German forces, but were warned and sheltered by Belgian civilians.
The Belgians put our boys in the doors and the windows of houses, and there they stood. and had a grandstand view of the German army moving out the road straight in front of them. The main part of the company advanced, and eventually we took our position in the actual ditch that was used by the Royal Irish in 1914 when they first met the Hun. And we stayed right there because we had been relieved by 28th.
While the city was being cleared, first news of the coming armistice arrived at the senior headquarters. The 3rd Division got the word at 6:40 a.m. They passed it on at once to Brigadier General Clark.
I was wakened by my staff captain, and he showed me this telegram. Hostilities will cease at 11 hours, November 11th. Troops will stand fast on the line reached at that hour, which will be reported to Corps headquarters. Defensive precautions will be maintained. There will be no intercourse of any description with the enemy. Further instructions follow.
Brigadier General Alexander Ross of the 6th Brigade, who was even then relieving the 4th Brigade to the east of Mons, got his signal at that same time.
I got the word on the way in. I stopped at 4th Brigade headquarters. They had relayed the message from Marshal Foch right down through all the channels, and that message I simply passed on with a note to my battalion commanders not to take any unnecessary risks, but pointing out to them that the area in which they were operating was practically uninhabited, and if they happened to stop on that line, they would probably stop without any habitation, which gave them some incentive to endeavor to reach the two very comfortable villages that lay ahead of them, which they did, and promptly by the 11th hour, they were on that line of the canal which was ordered, and they had their own villages and were very warmly received by the population and were very happy. We were 4 miles front of Mons, which is farther than any other troops engaged.
I ended up in this village of Heon in the courtyard of a large house, and there was a squadron of British cavalry who had been there in this same spot in 1914. There was also, in the fork of a tree above our heads, a little German field gun shell sticking in the tree, which had been fired there in 1914, and the inhabitants pointed this out to us. We weren't in the front line anymore because the 6th Brigade had gone by, and we had been relieved. And so we proceeded to get some food and cook it. And while we were doing this, one of our fighter airplanes, a little Camel aircraft, came and dived over us, waving a Union Jack. And shortly thereafter, the cavalry unit received an armistice order, and it was received by everybody with the greatest of skepticism.
No one believed it. Eventually, though, we began to wonder whether there was something to it. I saw a staff officer coming up the Mons-Namur Road, so I went over and stopped him to find out if there was anything to this, because the rumor had been getting stronger. Well, he hadn't heard it either. So while we were talking, a runner came along, and he told us that it really was true. The war was over.
In the back of many minds, there was a nasty, gnawing little thought.
I always remember the late W.A. Orr making the remark, wouldn't it be hell to be knocked off on the last day? But of course, we all thought that.
There was a sergeant of ours who had the DCM and the MM. Came out with the 1st Division. He'd gone right through the war, and he was a curious fellow and a very courageous fellow, and he just couldn't keep down. There was a canal at Mons, and at 10:45 in the morning when we were walking along the canal, he had to get up and find out what was going on. He was hit with a sniper's bullet and fell in the canal. It was a terrible tragedy.
There has always been a heightened feeling of sadness and an added poignancy to the tragedy of the war's last casualties. The lads who almost made it. Young Private Price of the 28th Battalion was the last Canadian soldier to die on the field of battle.
Major Ross, one of our officers there, told us that we were to halt on the bank of this river, or canal, to wait for further orders. Well, just about this time, this Price, he came over to me and he said, "What do you think of those houses across the road there?" Well, there were brick houses facing us with bricks knocked out that looked like a wonderful spot to stick a machine gun out of, you know, or a rifle or anything like that. So I said, "I don't like the look of it. Out on this road here, we're just sitting ducks." He said, "You know, I think we should go across there and see what's in those houses." So I said, "Fine." So So he said, let's get a couple of other guys to go across with us. And so we got three other machine gunners. And we went across. Well, when we got to the bridge, on a little knoll or hill off to our right, we could see Germans mounting machine guns. No doubt about that, they're mounting machine guns there. How many, we didn't know. But we walked across this steel bridge, and all we found in these houses were old Belgian people. And then the machine guns opened up. Oh, boy, they knocked bricks off this house and knocked the shingles off and hit this bridge that we had come across. Looked like an emery wheel, the way the bullets were ricocheting off that steel, you know. But these are brick houses, you know, and they're pretty substantial. And there was a brick fence ran around this first house. So Price said, let's go outside and see what's going on outside here. So the two of us went outside, and all of a sudden, bang, one shot came from way up the end of the street. Got him right through the back and through the heart. And he fell dead right in my arms there. It was not an accidental shot, it was a sniper, like, you know. If there'd been two there, he got both of us. And I leaned down behind the fence there and went in and got the other boy, told him that he was killed, you know. What's the matter? There's not a sound. No machine guns fired. Everything is quiet. One said, they'll wait until we start across that bridge. They'll get us then. But we walked across the bridge. No firing then. Nothing ever fired. And I went right up to Major Ross and told him that Price was killed. Oh, gee, did he blow a fuse, you know. The war's over, he said. The war's over. Well, I said, I can't help that. He said, what the hell did you go across there for? He had no orders to go across there. So we went across to see what was in those brick houses over there. They looked like good spots for somebody to pick us off there. Hell of a note, he said, to think that that would happen right when the war's over. And we never even thought about the war being over then, you know. And poor old Price, he never knew that it was over, you know. He was just doing his job. We didn't always get orders to do everything that we did.
The last time I visited Mons, my attention was drawn to two small markers in a military cemetery. The first is marking the grave of Lieutenant Deese of the Royal Irish Fusiliers, who was killed on the 23rd day of August 1914, the day that the troops first met, and the first Victoria Cross in the British Army. And almost side by side is the grave of a young private by the name of Price from Saskatchewan, who was killed on the 11th day of November 1918. Between the opening and closing of those two graves, the carnage, the murder, the massacre of troops all the way from Switzerland to the North Sea is overwhelming.
During the last 24 hours, we lost 11 men. The burgomaster asked if the city fathers might take charge of the funeral, and that request was granted. Immediately, they turned the old city hall into a chapel. The 11 coffins were laid on trestles covered with black palls with silver lining. Hour after hour, the citizens passed by and piled the coffins with flowers.
It's the first time I'd seen a coffin since I went over there. All the boys that were killed were buried in a blanket. So the city of Mons gave every man a decent coffin.
When it came time for the funeral, we moved off a long procession headed by the pipe band to the little cemetery that lay outside the city. And there the service, brief but moving, was held. There were two notable speeches given, one by the burgomaster and one by the provincial representative of the province of Hainaut, in which Mons is situated. And I'd like to read to you the closing words of the provincial representative's speech. This is what he said. Gentlemen of the Canadian Corps, we bow, filled with respect and deep feeling, before the tomb of your comrades. In so doing, we enshrine in our hearts the remembrance of what they were and of what they have done for us. At this moment, alas, far beyond the Atlantic, there are mothers and fathers, wives and children, lovers, brothers and sisters, who await those who live no longer, not knowing as yet that they lie here. Tell them, we beg of you, that this little parcel of Belgian soil is for us the most sacred of all, that it is forever part of Canadian territory, a priceless treasure set like a jewel in the burial ground of our own people. And so after the prayers and the last post, which is one of the most poignant calls that the army knows, the benediction was pronounced and we turned and left them. Not in a corner of a foreign land, but in that parcel of ground deeded to Canada forever.
In the years that followed the war, the sacred memory of those who gave their lives to capture Mons was perverted into a bitter attack upon Sir Arthur Currie. In the end, backed by the men he'd led, he sued for libel, and he won.
They say that Currie threw away a whole lot of lives just for the glory of taking Mons before the armistice came in. That's a lot of darn nonsense. We were doing our job the same as we did any other day. The Jerrys were killing our boys back in Jemappes. They were shelling us there. They were shelling everywhere. Why should we sit there and be killed? No, sir.
I always thought it was a lot of nonsense, this attack on Sir Arthur. And the way the Canadian Corps, of all ranks, got behind Sir Arthur during that time was simply terrific. Anything from privates to major generals all wanted to know how they could help. I was one of the witnesses in that Coburg libel suit. Quite a crowd of us went up from the 42nd and gave evidence. I was on the witness stand about an hour myself. Currie had his orders just like all of us. And the orders were to keep pushing the Germans back. We didn't know when they were going to collapse. He was a great soldier and a great Canadian. And to my mind, that whole attack on Sir Arthur was disgraceful.
Mons was the most important railway center in that part of Europe. And our hope was to get far enough beyond Mons so that it couldn't be reached by medium artillery, that nothing under an 8-inch gun could hit it. Well, that meant we had to be at least 7,500 yards beyond Mons. And that was the reason for speed and for hurry and pushing people out of the way. We had to get out as far as possible. And all this criticism of the Corps commander by people who didn't understand the reason for pressure is so iniquitous.
It must be remembered that the British and the Australians and the French were also moving forward right up until 11 o'clock. And it would have been disastrous if we had held back from going into Mons, left the flanks open on both sides so that whatever army or men were to our right and left, they would have had undue casualties.
Far from resenting the fact that they were ordered into battle on the 10th and 11th of November, there were many who resented the ceasefire, who questioned the wisdom of stopping when the Germans were beaten and running. There are those who question it still.
They should have went in and put Germany where it should have been put and finished the job. They were on the run and they couldn't have stood very long, and we'd have put them where Mr. Hitler wouldn't have come back in the short time that he did, as they'd have taken over Germany at that time instead of just going to the outskirts. That was politicians that done that, Wilson and these people. It wasn't the soldiers, it wasn't Foch or the generals that made that armistice.
Nevertheless, the armistice was made. How did the soldiers feel as time ticked up to 1,100 hours?
Well, none of us knew, of course, just exactly what the armistice was or what it meant or whether it was genuine or not. We had our instructions to take these precautions, and that's why we put out these posts up on the top of this hill. The cavalry were on in front of us quite some distance by then, and they were trying to keep in touch with the Germans, and we had the odd message from them that they were half a mile away and that sort of thing. But we simply watched our step, that was all.
Barney Wood, who was commanding B Company, came up against a detachment of German machine gunners and had worked himself into a position where they could charge. The men had fixed their bayonets and were going to charge when the signal went up. The church bells all started to ring. We could hear the sound of the guns dying along the front. The German officer in command of this detachment stood up and signaled, and the Germans got out of the trench, emptied the water out of their machine guns, marched back in formation across the canal, and we advanced forward into the village of Havre when the first shift of miners were coming out of the mines. They'd gone down with the Germans in occupation. The word had got down, of course, and I think they came out earlier than their shift, and there was terrific celebration.
I was standing on the slope of this hill. I could see Mons on my left. I could hear the bands playing. I could hear the people cheering and shouting. and all the rejoicing in the village and behind, but out front, it was just dead silence, and we really couldn't believe it. That fire reaction, the troops in action. And I went to the front line immediately afterwards, and there was certainly no elation, no rejoicing. They wanted to go to bed. It was the end, and they just couldn't realize it. It came so suddenly.
It was sprung on us so suddenly, we couldn't realize it. We kind of stood around, didn't know what to make of it. The armistice was on, and the war was over, and you couldn't realize it. You're hypnotized. You couldn't realize anything. I mean, you're wondering what it was all about. You're fighting the day before, and men being killed, and the next day, the war is all finished. Things went through your mind like that. It was impossible to realize that the war was over.
I suppose it was let down feeling. A sort of sadness rather than elation. That night, I think we tried to celebrate, but it wasn't a spontaneous affair. It was an effort to celebrate.
The cavalry brigade, now with the 4th British Army, felt much the same reaction.
I can't remember the town where they sounded the ceasefire, but we pulled into a big farmyard. It was starting to rain then. We was all wondering what's going to happen. So all of a sudden we heard, "Fall in the trumpeters." So the trumpeters went on the highway and the sound of the ceasefire. The boys just gave a little shout, and that was all.
Men of the 85th Battalion couldn't even do that.
Our only place for a headquarters was in the cellar of a house. The Germans had flooded the whole thing with tear gas, and the tear gas affects your throat. We were a whispering battalion for a week. There wasn't a man standing in our parade that could shout if he wanted to when the word came about the armistice. They didn't believe it, as a matter of fact, but they couldn't shout if they wanted to.
There was no cheering, just a sense of relief. It seemed to be a letdown somehow. And then, of course, we begin to think about the fellows that had just got it.
This chap, Clarence McFall, he and I had chummed together, and I married his sister after I came back. Well, I had just got word that he'd been killed, and it's very, very sad. You lose your best pal, and you didn't just feel like celebrating. There was something about it that morning that it wasn't jubilant to me.
We didn't get word to come back into the city until well after dark, and the ones that were in the city had the celebrations. We could hear it from where we were out in the outskirts, the bells ringing and the cheering and the bands playing.
As for the civilians, right on the tick of 11 o'clock, they came up out of the cellars in which they'd been hiding for 48 hours and really let go. They scampered around yelling, "Vive les Anglais and vive les Canadiens." And they dished out coffee and cognac free, as if there was no end to the stuff. Somebody hauled out a piano and began to play Katie. Everybody began to dance. The burgomaster of Sipley in full regalia climbed out upon a watering trough and delivered some impassioned appeal to which nobody would listen. Brand new Belgian flags flew everywhere, and they put on a real show for
us. I remember a civilian running down the street in his wooden shoes, crying, "Hang out your flags." And from the strange places that they'd hidden their flags, rolled up in a blind or under the carpet and so on, they dug out their flags, and when the sun rose on Mons, it was on a beflagged and decorated city. At 7 o'clock, the pipe band led the headquarter details into Mons. There was a perfect furor of enthusiasm in the response. And I remember an old woman clinging to the stirrup of my saddle and offering me the heel of a very stale-looking brown loaf. It was all she had, but her heart was in it. It's impossible for us to realize what it means to be prisoners of an intolerable regime for 4 years and then suddenly to be free.
And as the day wore on, the joy of the Belgian citizens infected them, and one suspects there were other outside influences at work. At any rate, the troops did celebrate.
We received a message that there would be a victory parade in Mons, and off we set from Jemappes. A very happy parade that day. We had not only our own two bands, pipers and brass band, but we also had the RCR band. So it made it quite a gala occasion for us and for the natives of Jemappes, too. Our troops, who during the First War marched in fours, were marching about eight abreast, each one of the four being accompanied by a Belgian mamselle. We did look like Coxey's army, I'm sure. But we enjoyed it, and it was quite obvious they did.
There was a large celebration held in the public square in Mons. General Sir Arthur Currie came into Mons with his staff on the afternoon of November the 11th, and at that time, there was an official reception tendered to him and all of the troops in the vicinity. All of us were presented with a miniature medal by the burgomaster, and owing to the hospitality which was extended to all ranks by the citizens of Mons, it was a very gay day and far from dry.
The big square was roped off there at Mons. I had a pretty sweet jag off. I wanted to get down to the other side, so I just walked under the rope and ran down across it. And I was going this way and that way, but I made it, and nobody stopped me. We were back 2 years when they showed the picture of the road back in the Strand Theater. I said to the wife, I said, I'd like to see that picture of the road back. I said, might be good. She says, all right. So we got a couple of nice seats there, and then the crowd began to gather in. And the picture came on, and everybody was interested, and they were watching it. Till that come onto that picture. And I was just as plain going down across that square as I am here, and somebody recognized me down in the audience. And he just gave one whoop out of me. He said to me, there's going one down through there. He says, as drunk as you. Well, the wife just took one look at me like that. She looked. And I said, holy heavens above us. They don't let on. Keep still. She said, for heaven's sake, is that the way you want them or? I never took a better picture in my life.
As the day went along, everybody in the whole city of Mons began to celebrate. Every single house and every building was decorated with a flag or flags. And all the civilians turned out, and all the pubs opened up and served free beer and free cognac and free everything else. And there was a tremendous outburst of rejoicing and celebration in the whole city of Mons, which went on far into the night. And all the soldiers participated in this.
For souvenir purposes, the civilians removed all of the buttons from our tunics, our identification badges, as well as our hat badges. And frankly, at the end of the day, I believe that my tunic was held together by safety pins.
In Mons that evening, we were standing on one of the main thoroughfares, and we saw this crowd coming down, and it was just a mass of people, and there was band instruments playing, and people were waving flags, a real hullabaloo, and you know, they just carried everybody with them.
The people went through the city in parties, the civilians and soldiers arm in arm, roaring through the streets, or singing songs at the top of their voices, and they would turn and invade one staminae, and everybody'd have a drink, and then they'd all come out in the file and go down to the next place. It was a spontaneous and unorganized celebration.
I'd already received permission to go down to Paris. I'd never been there. And four of us, our general officers, started out in the motor car to go to Paris. And as we went down, not knowing anything about the armistice at all, we saw crowds on the road, and growing crowds, and hilarious crowds. And we thought they were greeting us. We thought it was a tribute to us as Canadians. And we took it that way. And we got into Paris itself, and then we were enlightened. And the treatment we got in Paris was simply wonderful. The old men with their silk hats would stop in front of us, put the hats on the pavement, and come and throw their arms around us and kiss us. And the young ladies did the same thing. Everyone, they thought we were wonderful. And we were commencing to think it too.
The whole of the Western world went just a little mad with joy that day.
Armistice Day in London was something out of this world. Something out of this world. Somebody said, let's go to the palace. So we went to Buckingham Palace. And there was a crowd there, swaying, cheering, singing, God save the King. King, the Queen came out on the balcony. They were cheered again and again. And it was a very moving sight indeed.
I got out of hospital on Armistice Day. It had been arranged that I had lunch with a couple of my uncles, both of whom were in the church. And they had invited me to have lunch at the Junior Constitutional Club, which today is Canberra House in Trafalgar Square. And I drove up to the Junior Constitutional Club with about 15 munition girls sitting on top of the taxi. Well, I think my uncles were rather shocked.
In time, the loud rejoicing dwindled down. The crowds went home to beds around the world, and the troops were left in Flanders. Their homes, a long way off, further than Tipperary, and their job was not yet done. The German armies were beaten, but they were still intact, withdrawing toward the Rhine. Someone must follow.
The 1st and 2nd Divisions were the Canadian contingent to the Rhine. As far as we were concerned, the war was still on. It was only an armistice. And we moved, therefore, in proper formation. And I commanded the advance guard of the 2nd Division all the way to the Rhine. We moved then by easy stages, foot march all the way. We ran into bad weather when we got to the Ardennes. It was cold and wet, very miserable. A very narrow road and poor accommodation. It wasn't very comfortable.
Well, neither were the trenches. But men who would cheerfully accept the miseries of trench life so long as there was a war to be won found the discomforts of this epilogue unbearable. They could accept the fact that they must march to the Rhine, but must they do it in full marching order, lugging 60 pounds of gear, their ammunition, and their rifles?
You can probably put yourself in our position. Myself, I'd been in France for 3 years, in the army for 4, and I didn't want to go to the Rhine. I wanted to get the hell home out of there.
I was just going to division, and I got to the place where they told me division headquarters was, and I saw quite a gathering in the square, and a fella up on a bandstand or something or another, and he was haranguing the troops. Will we carry our packs tomorrow? And you'd hear 1,000 voices say no. Where did the colonel get all his ribbons? From us. Are we going to carry those packs tomorrow? No. What are we going to do? Sit down. And the next day, they sat on the side of the road and wouldn't move. Until at last, some of the sergeants got around and talked them into it. I thought they had a fair grouch. Why should soldiers who've been through hell have to carry a 60-pound pack on their back, as well as their arms and ammunition? And I says, they've got a legitimate kick.
The surly mood passed quickly. The traditional good humor could not be long disguised, and the men marched on toward the Rhine.
I saw that we would arrive at the border at a little place called Poto at exactly noon. So we went into a field just short of the border, and the M.O. and the padre got out, laid a bandage across the road to mark the border, and then we heard a clatter coming up the road, and here was Sir Arthur Currie with his staff and a little escort of cavalry. And without a word, the troops gave a cheer there that I can still hear ringing. It was the heartiest thing I ever heard in my life. And I wish that some of these people that thought that Currie was unpopular with the troops could have heard it. They didn't know the extent to which he had saved them, but they sensed it. So, headed by the corps and divisional commanders, and with the band playing the Maple Leaf, we made the Corps official entry into Germany. And I think most of us were thinking of the lads who hadn't lived to see that day and wishing they could have been there to see it. As we went over the border, riding along in front of the battalion, you could feel it behind. You'd feel the feeling in it.
The strange, sad thing was that so comparatively few of the men who'd borne the heat and burden of winning the battles were there, and that was one of the sad thing.
The march to the Rhine finished up in a race between the 1st and 2nd Divisions. Quite unexpectedly, I happened to have the advance guard. And just before noon, I was just mounting my horse, and the signaler was just going to leave the telephone when a message came through from brigade, very excited brigade major. He said, Brigadier wants you to get to the Rhine tomorrow as soon as possible. So I said, right. 10:15, 10:30, something of that kind. The next morning, we hit the Rhine, telephoned through that we'd reached the Rhine, given the time. All I heard was a fervent thank God. That afternoon, I think I had pretty nearly every member of the divisional brigade staff in to see me to shake my hand. It appeared that they had suddenly discovered that the 2nd Division was further ahead than they thought, see? Hence this frantic message. Sir Archie MacDonald wouldn't have been fit to live with for a week, you know, if the 2nd Division got there before the 1st.
We got there on December the 12th, and on the 13th we were to march across the Rhine in style, and It was given to the 1st Canadian Division to lead that wing of the British Army across the Rhine, and the 3rd Brigade was given the right to lead the 1st Division. And in the four commanding officers tossing, RCO won the toss. So we were all formed up, ready to go. It was a mean sort of a day. Very few Germans on the streets, of course. They were behind their windows watching. And Sir Archie MacDonald rode up, and he said, "Oh, good morning, Wardle." He said, "Your battalion looks magnificent today." "Thank you, sir," said Wardle. He said, "You know," he said, "I'd like very much to have a Highland battalion lead the Highland Brigade across the bridge." He said, "Don't you think that you could let one of the others lead it?" "No, sir," said Wardle. "We won the toss. Your battalion's a hell of a mess," he said, and rode off. So our band led the parade playing Rule Britannia.
When we got into Hennef, about 30 kilometers on the other side of the Rhine, when we marched down the street, well, there wasn't a soul on the street, but you could see people peeking from out behind the curtains. And we found out why afterwards.
Apparently they were told that the Canadian army was made up primarily of Red Indians, and there was danger of scalping, and they were to hide all the silverware they could possibly hide.
They were quite surprised when they found out we were civilized.
We were not supposed to fraternize with these people, but I think we were a little too harsh with them. For instance, I can remember the order went out that they were to salute us as we passed, that is to say, the officers. And I didn't take too much stock of this, because they were human after all. I didn't want them kowtowing to me. And there were a lot of knocking the men's hats off as we passed, and they resented this, especially the German sailors. They nearly rioted in Cologne when I was there. I know we were called out to quell this near riot. And then the order was cancelled, and we were told just to be decent with them, and we were that way. We went into a village named Unter Eschbach, and the villagers there were extremely courteous and very decent people. But it was quite an experience. The people were very short of food, and I remember what great pleasure it gave us to share our rations with them. And in return, they would organize little parties for us. We wanted to be friendly with them.
The realization was a long time sinking in, but now they knew that it was really over. The private soldier and the brigadier general made peace with Fritz, and Fritz's wife and kids, and Fritz's dog. No longer did they think of him as Han.
I'd let this Oberst have his own little cottage down here while we took over his big house, you see. It was just before Christmas, and up came a message from, could he borrow his own piano over there because the children wanted to sing the Christmas carols, and he would be very grateful. And I said, "Oh, well, yes, all right, he can have it." I got a batch of troops, and then we heaved the piano down to the cottage sort of thing. And then he said, "Won't you overlook the fraternizing for one night," he said, "and come and join us?" So we adjourned after it down to the cottage. And here he was. His wife had been quite a prominent opera singer before the war. And she started singing various things. And the next thing, I had these two little small fry on my knee, little plaques in here, thing, while we merrily sang Heilige Nacht, all the old German songs.
Christmas that year meant even more to another group of Canadians who had not made peace with the Germans, the men in the prison camps beyond the zone of occupation. I never forget the train pulled out of this camp and onto the docks in Hamburg. And it was Christmas Day, 1918. There were soldiers everywhere, on the running boards, on the top of the railway cars and everything. I'm sure there must be about 2,500 of them. And we get off at hooping and yelling, and there, what do you suppose we saw? At the very dock, right in Hamburg, there she was, the city of Poona, with a Union Jack floating at the stern. Oh, gee, the sight of that flag after months and months in that bloody country, you know. It got so you wondered if you ever would get back. On the 5th January, 1919, the 1st and 2nd Divisions began their return to Belgium to rejoin the rest of the Corps. No trouble this time. They went by train.
A damp, dark winter in the Low Countries is pretty tough. We were in the middle of an agricultural plain, and there was precious little we could do for our men. I was leaving my office about 6:30. One night, I was going down the village cobblestones, and two men passed me. And one said to the other, "Well, Bill, what are you going to do tonight?" And the other chap, with a disgusted tone of voice, said, "Hell, what is there to do? I think I'll go to bed."
We were there for the winter, with nothing to do, no entertainment, and not the impetus of the war to give the feeling of urgency, you see. But the men were perfect. I don't mean to say there was no sins committed. Of course, there were, there always are. But there was no case of somebody disobeying an order deliberately, let alone two or three men going together on it.
And nevertheless, to a certain extent, the ties of discipline began to loosen from the day of the armistice. In one first-class regiment, a somewhat sardonic trend developed towards its officers. The men would salute, but with what one officer described as unspoken insolence in their eyes. This particular regiment solved the problem in a certain fashion. They had one or two rather good boxers in the regiment, and at all sports meets, two of these officers would be put into the ring with instructions to knock hell out of each other. This was done, and it created a great deal of enthusiasm. The troops cheered such performances to the echo, and thereafter there was less insolence in their eyes.
The majority of people wanted to go to England. Well, you could not give leave to everybody because the transportation facilities were not available. So they came to the conclusion that we'd send the whole of Canadian Corps from France to England, and then they'd be there for about a month, and then they were transferred.
We were shipped up to a camp in North Wales at Rhyl. I spent Christmas there and New Year there, and I was really disappointed. I had expected to spend at least one of them at home.
When we got to Rhyl, there was no organization. The war, of course, was over, and the discipline was pretty loose. And day or two after, we got two or three mobs together that wanted to leave and they wanted to pay. And a captain appeared. He talked to the men about playing the game and being good soldiers and see what he could do for them. The next morning, all the boys turned down parade, and they produced some PT instructors. The last thing I saw, the PT instructors, they were running faster than ever they run in their lives with the troops after them. It was just a red ragged boo.
The cabinet in Ottawa wanted the troops to be returned first out, first in, which is a ridiculous situation. It couldn't be done. For example, the clerks and the Army Service Corps personnel, well, they didn't have as many casualties as the others. The result is they'd be all the ones going away. But who's going to look after the troops? It was an impossible situation. And Curry naturally opposed that right away. He said, no, it can't be done. Above all, the value of maintaining morale was important. It could best be done by keeping the men as long as possible in the units in which they had fought together and won battles. Finally, Sir Robert Borden wired Ottawa, from every point of view, it was desirous to demobilize the Corps by units.
There were a number of conscripts were sent back to Canada before the fighting troops were. I think it was involved with the bonus. They got a bonus if you had been 6 months overseas. If you'd been back to Canada for less than 6 months, you didn't get the bonus.
They used to hold parades twice a day. You'd go out, stand around, and some fellow would get up on a big rostrum and start reading off a list of numbers and names. The conscripts of those days, we call them umpty umpties. I remember one particular case. This chap, I think he was a company sergeant major, he called out one number. It was 80888. Oh, there was nothing else but eights and zeros in it. There must have been about eight or nine digits in it. And some fella behind me shouts out, that SOB hasn't left Canada yet.
Troops were transferred to Canada much quicker than was first anticipated. 18 months was the original estimate that would be required to bring the troops back. As a matter of fact, two-thirds of the overseas forces reached home within 5 months. And before a year had passed, repatriation was virtually completed.
It was a big chunk out of one's life. It was a wonderful experience. There were bad times. But it was an experience that I think that enriches one's life a great deal, a very great deal.
I got back greatly enlarged by the war in mind and in spirit and in personality. I was a bookworm, a quiet little bookworm. When I went and I came home, a rather tough character. I immediately returned to a job which was already larger by reason of what I had been through.
Over 50,000 Canadians would not come home again. Gregory Clark asks, What do we think of our dead?
What do we think of our dead? We put a monument to them when we give them 2 minutes of silence once a year, which I regard as an affront, because where you've lost someone immediately dear to you, you're silent an area of your mind and your heart, your whole living life.
Here, dead lie we, because we did not choose to live and shame the land from which we sprung. Life, to be sure, is nothing much to lose, but young men think it is. And we were young.
That's the tragedy of a war. It's fought by the youth of the country, the very best there are. I have a photograph of the 19th Battalion having their New Year's dinner in Siegburg in Germany. And the astonishing thing about it is the extreme youth of all the men in it. Looking at them now, they look like boys. And they were. Hardly any of them were over 25 years of age. These are the men that won the First World War and the Second.
I want to pay my own tribute to the men who taught me so much of what true manhood is. I mean the fellow in the rear rank, Private Number 416729, John Smith. He was the man who really won the war. I can see him now in my mind's eye, coming out of the line, cumbered with muddy gear, his steel helmet at a rakish angle, the sweat running down over his grimed face, the eyes that might have been bitter but never were. The private in the rear ranks, the man who grumbled at the rations and cursed the working parties and referred to his sergeant in language which continually amazed me by its vocabulary. The man who was embarrassed when he was praised and acutely uncomfortable should he be decorated, and yet everywhere and always could laugh. He was the fellow that broke the Hindenburg line and opened the road for the final victory. The man in the rear ranks, whose shattered body filled the trenches over which the guns drove in swift pursuit. I'll never forget him, and I thank God I knew him.
Next week, the aftermath, a hard look at the Canada to which our fighting men returned, and the long view of an historian on the effects the conflict had upon the nation. The aftermath.